We're plowing on with our study in Romans, but the primary focus tonight is on the matter of love. We've been at that for several weeks, but it's a complex word, a complex concept. Loving hamburgers in the same breath that you're talking about loving God. You can imagine if you were a foreigner, not familiar with the language, you see, and you went into a place and somebody just before the meeting was saying, "Hey, have you been over to this hamburger stand? I just love their hamburgers." Then they go into the meeting and people start singing, "Oh, how I love Jesus," and so on. What's the thing? I mean, Jesus is certainly more than a patty of beef. So the word has been so confused and distorted. In fact, it's really an absurdity. It is one of the most absurd words in the English language because it makes no distinction whatsoever. Now, as I said, the Bible, written in Greek, makes the distinctions. When a Greek read the Bible, or one familiar with the Greek language, the Jews, people like Peter, were very familiar with the Greek language, because Greek in those days had the broad exposure that English does today. Greek was a very common language of business and daily communications. But the word love has commanded, love your enemies, love your neighbors, love God. Of course, as the word English is applied, it doesn't mean anything. But in Greek, the word meant care about God, care about your neighbors, care about your enemies. In the ancient world, you had a prevailing barbarism and prevailing might makes right philosophy, survival of the fittest. In the Roman era, as you know, the conquests, the brutalities that were rampant in those days, people being brought under slavery and brutalized and ravaged and so forth. And that was the common order of the day. Now, after the Christian era, that is after Christ came, there began to be a shift of things. And whereas you did have a period called the Dark Ages after the fall of Rome, and these things rather prevailed, these brutalities, then there a change came in the mood of the world, of people in the world, perhaps under the influence of Christianity. You had first the Renaissance that came in the 12th and 13th centuries. Now, the Renaissance may seem to be a very earthy kind of a thing or a secular kind of thing, but there was a lot in it of rebirth. That's what the word means, rebirth. The rebirth of culture, which brought with it the rebirth of literature and painting, art, and so forth, which is not a simple thing because you have Leonardo da Vinci, for example, coming at that time, a painting of the Last Supper, the religious themes of painting. In the 12th and 13th centuries were a sparking of a movement all through Europe, up through the Middle Ages, to the time of the Reformation, which brought about a new condition of caring in the world. See, today in our society in America, we talk about liberals and conservatives, right? The left wing and the right wing. Okay. Now, you have to see that in the right setting to understand what it means in America. In the Middle Ages, in political science, the conservative, the right wing, if you may call it that, was the philosophy that the rights are derived from the self. A person could keep whatever they could get. You have a right to whatever you could get and keep, is the way it was. That was the old conservatism of the Middle Ages. The liberal was the one that began talking about the revival of humanity, the revival of freedom, the revival of the idea of people participating in their own destiny, in their own government, and so forth. So beginning with the Renaissance, where you had a revival of interest in the individual, the person, interest in society as a unit. Out of that was born the liberal movement of the Middle Ages and the everything up through the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries the emergence of the feeling that human beings have a place under the sun and that they have their rights. And whereas prior to that time you had the concept of what is called the divine right of kings, that is, that a king had absolute authority and no one had the right to question him. That was that he got his authority from God and no one had a right to question him. Let's see, the Reformation and the Revolution, the revolutionary period of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries was a total systemic revolution in society which brought about the revolution of culture, the revolution of science. The Copernican theory came in that time, Galileo, so the revolution of the explorations, the discovery of other lands. The Reformation, the revolution of religion, the religious reformation with Martin Luther, all of these things came at this time to lift mankind out of the doldrums into a new mood of sensitivity to the individual. Now, you may say, what does that have to do with religion? And I have to say to you, if you tie all the threads of history together, you'll find plunked right down in the middle of all this human renaissance is the Reformation, which brought about a new sense of our personal relationship to God. Under the Roman Church in the early days, in the Middle Ages, the ritual aspects of it tended to cloud over the personal aspects. But then came the revival of interest in the individual, the personal relationship to Christ, not just in a religious way, but in a personal, private way. And that emerged at that period of time. So now, in today's society, see, America was born in the era of the revival of the right of the individual to participate in his government. The idea that a person's rights derive from the society they were a member of rather than something within themselves. In other words, you don't have rights just within yourself. You don't have a right to be independently whatever you want to be. Your rights relate to the people around you. If you were to draw a diagram of this and you were to talk about left and right, and you started in the old pattern of the 17th and 18th century, earlier the 16th century, you have on the right the conservative view which says rights are independently held and have nothing to do with anybody around you. You get what you have a right to whatever you can get and keep. The left of that is the idea that society, that a person's rights come from the society they're a member of. Now, everything in American political history has to be seen on the left of that line. Even conservatism in America today is based on that idea that we don't have independent rights. They belong to the society. We don't have anything more to do with, basically, our society, with the old idea that might makes right or that you have your rights independently of others. Now, again, you're going to say, well, what does that have to do with faith? It has this to do with it. We're talking about a caring consciousness about others around us. And you don't have to be a spiritual giant or have some grand religious experience for that to be true in you. Now, whence did this come? I'm saying it emerged was born in the religious revivals. That is, the revival of religious experience. I'm not talking about evangelistic revivals per se, but I'm talking about the awakening of people to the claims of religion and of God and so forth. The great tide of religious fervor that swept through the world after the Renaissance in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries is very marked. And so today in America, as I've said before, 80% of the population of America is pretty deeply rooted in faith. And that is why America as a nation has this great sense of caring. We have elected to keep pace with the needs of the poor of our country. Now, someone might challenge that and say, well, we're not keeping up with Social Security and we're not doing this, we're not doing that. But in the main, the American people have elected to vote for programs and parties and systems that pay attention to the needs of the distressed. And there's still a floor of poverty in America rises in keeping with the amount of money they have in Washington. So if they have the money to spend, the floor of poverty keeps rising to meet it. So in other words, anybody in this country that is classed in the poverty levels is entitled to numerous programs that you may think that everybody's being aced out of help, but I've been through this a great deal with the aged and with others, and I know the program of the OAS and other things where there's so many ways that people that are depressed can get help. Food stamps have been a very important part of that. Other thing, the system is abused, to be sure. What I'm really saying is the great sense of a caring consciousness in America is noteworthy, and it is the country where faith is the most vibrant and most widespread. All right, I'm going to come back to the center. You may think I'm way out in the woods. I still have put the marks on the trees so I can get back to the highway. But when Paul says that we must love one another, that we must love our neighbor, the word that he uses has to do with that kind of caring consciousness, which is a mark of those who are identified with God, and is not something that comes only by some very highly specialized spiritual experience. See what I'm saying? On the other hand, the word has nothing to do with emotional feelings. You pay your taxes regularly in many different ways, more than you may realize. Now, when you put that money, put that check in the envelope, or you pay that tax money, whatever it is, you are not stopping to say a prayer for the depressed of America. I'm sure of that. You're not thinking how grand it is to help these poor benighted souls. You don't think that at all. You have no feeling about it at all, except perhaps a bit negative. I wish they'd take care of themselves. Why should I have to take care of them? But you don't feel one way or the other, probably. Yet, the money you're spending, do you not see that when you are paying taxes in America, that in itself is its own indicator of what? Of a society that has elected to pay attention to the needs of its people. And you're part of that society. You vote for the people that go to the government and have the power to make changes in the laws. And all of America is, all of us, is universally agreed that we ought to take care of these people. We don't always agree on how to do it. We don't always agree on the extent of it, so forth. But we all agree. We have set up a system. And we've all participated in setting it up that allows us to make that statement to the world that America cares about its poor. But even though people may not realize it, we are participating in a great many programs around the world of helping the disadvantaged. The third world people and the Latin Americans. Now, there are lots of controversies over how we do it, how much we should do it, whether or not we should do it, and so forth. But America is sensitive to the needs of the world. And here is the Soviet Union engaged in what we regarded as a heinous act of exploitation in Afghanistan, and we thought that we would therefore penalize them by an embargo on grain. But that didn't even stand up much. There was very little sympathy in America for that. I mean, the whole attitude of America may have been very naive, but the whole attitude of America is, let's not use food as a weapon. And that's been true in a lot of our programs. When we were hurting in this oil business, and we had quite a lot of leverage on the food matter, we never let ourselves get into a position of using food as a weapon. The general mood was, let's let people eat. Let's not worry about that part of it. Now, I'm going to have to say to you, I am trying to lay out a principle here that is not just one man's opinion. I'm trying to lay a principle out that is substantial to you, to say to you that we are a caring people, that you and I are a caring people in our relationship to Christ, but also in our relationship to the world, and where faith has gone, caring has gone. Not as a specialized religious experience, but as a common part of the faith that has gone there. You do follow this injunction. Where the Bible says, love your enemies, you do. I want to prove that to you. I want to say to you tonight that on that same premise, when you think about some person that you may not like too well, if they're in trouble, if they're hurting, you're going to help them if you can. I've also said the moment faith comes, comes also the caring about one's family and others. You pray for them. You, always in our meetings, that's one of the first things. I have a friend that's in need or a relative or somebody. That caring comes. Now, you see, the Greeks, using their word agape, would agree with me perfectly. So that's right. That's what that word means. And if that is true, then you're following the commandment. The other side, the other word that is common in the New Testament is a word phile, which has to do with affection, family, friends. That is not always true in our relationship with others. We are not always friendly to them. They do things that hurt us and we don't like them. And the question immediately that comes up, well, is that Christian not to like people? Well, if you follow Jesus, it is. Jesus didn't like the Pharisees at all. I said that last week. He didn't like the Pharisees at all. He called them snakes. He called them sepulchers and serpents and every other name under the sun. He blasted away at them. Oh, you who stoned the prophets, he said, did this and this. And he was weeping. How often I would have gathered you as a mother hen gathers her chicks. His heart was open and weeping for these Pharisees, but he didn't like them at all. If you have people that have done something to you, if they've hurt you and you don't like them, well, you're in good company. Now, that doesn't mean you ought to turn around and poke them. You're not allowed to knock them flat, necessarily. Even that probably wouldn't get you thrown out of the kingdom. Might get you to the principal's office. God's pretty fair about some of those things. But the point I'm making is that you don't have to like the people that you care about, and it's more honest sometimes to admit that you don't like them than to put on some false front. Now, that is still, in a way, review and transitional to help you separate the realities of God's love in our spirit, which is changeless and permanent and strong, versus the vacillating human affections and feelings in the flesh, where you can feel at peace about your relationship to God, even if they're having negative feelings about this and that. Because, you see, those are human, and you're never going to be rid of them. If people in the church were honest, if pastors were honest with you, they'd have to say to you that no matter how many revival meetings they've been in, they still have trouble with their feelings. Now, they just ought to be honest about it. It is in husbands and wives. The situation is there. In fact, if we had more understanding of this, we'd probably have fewer divorces. You can't depend upon God to make things sweet and lovely in your relationship to other people. Oh, God, make that person like me. What if you wouldn't act so ornery? Maybe they would like you. See? Don't pray for Jesus to come and help you. Just behave yourself. That's the issue. Agape love is commanded. Affection has to be earned. Now, when Paul says, husbands, love your wives, use the word agape, and he's saying the same thing as when God said, love your enemies. Not that the wife or husband is an enemy, but they could be. They could be. There could be a lot of enmity. There are times when you may want to strangle them. See? Or the little kiddies, or vice versa, the parents. Times when you're not feeling very lovely toward each other. But feelings are fickle. You can't depend on them. They're up and down like a yo-yo. But what carries you is the stable sense of caring within. Well, you see, if we depended on these fickle human emotions, we'd be in trouble. The Lord puts up with us. It's like you do with the little kids. Like you come home at night, it's 12 o'clock at night, been traveling, little kids are asleep in the back seat, and you stop now and you're going to take them into a nice bed. They've got their all doubled up in the back seat, their feet up on the back and their head in the floor and whatnot, and they're all in mess. So now what are you going to do? You're going to take them out and you're going to put them in a nice, comfortable bed, nice warm blankets and so forth. But they will have none of it. You touch them and they start screaming, and it's 12 o'clock at night, and the dogs start barking, the neighbors throw the windows up. All this racket. Over what? Well, you want to take the kids and put them in a nice place, see? But they don't want anything to do with that. But you don't just say, oh, well, if that's the way you feel, well, goodbye, we'll leave you and shut the door. You just grab them in one to each arm or take them up and put them in bed. You don't pay any attention to their squealing, right? A lot of times you've had to not pay any attention to the squealing and just go on and do what has to be done. Now, that's true with Christ. He doesn't pay attention a lot of times to the squealing that goes on because he knows we don't know what we want. He knows our feelings are fickle and up and down, and they depend on whether we've had proper food to eat or whether we've slept well the night before or whether we've had our vitamins. Or, you know, there's so many different things that affect these feelings. But to try to make a spiritual thing out of it is just nonsense. To get people all hepped up over their feelings. Go to a meeting and they pray and all that. These great feelings, they hug each other and they go out and act as ornery as they ever did. It's all very temporary. In connection with psychology courses and so forth, we've been exposed to the matter of hypnotism. I've never been hypnotized. I wouldn't let it be done. But I've seen lots of demonstration of hypnotism, and so have many of you. Now, the problem with hypnotism is that whatever wonders it works are very temporary. So, for example, in a school situation, they may hypnotize the students. They have a wonderful time with their lessons that day, but the next day they're right back in the same old rut again. Well, what's the principle? The principle is relaxation so that the cortex becomes more receptive to signals of learning experience. So if you've ever been in a meeting or a place where they did this, you'll notice that relaxation is a key, and they start with the feet, the legs, and go right up until finally they want you to relax the very top of your head. So when you get in a condition of complete relaxation, the learning process is quite readily applied in many cases. Not everybody is subject to it. All right, but the problem with it is that it's temporary. The same with trying to hypnotize yourself to stop smoking or anything else. The problem with the playing with the emotions, the feelings, is too temporary. I think that in the church, in general, now understand when I speak of church, I'm talking about the expression of the body of Christ. I'm not talking about the body of believers. That's something else. I'm talking about the visible expression of the believers called the church. In the church, the feelings have been exploited in a heinous way. They try to get the feelings worked up to give money, to make commitments, to be saved. All these things are all feelings. I think it's unconscionable, if you want to know the truth. It is an unconscionable thing for pastors to work on the feelings of the people. They're doing damage. They're ravaging these poor souls. I think they're taking a very unfair advantage. They get them on guilt trips. So that they feel guilty if they don't pay in so much money or they don't help with the program of the church. They use, I would say, that in a completely unconscionable way, a large number of leaders in the church today are exploiting the congregations in a matter of their feelings. And they are doing damage, such damage that it lasts a lifetime. in the matter of guilt feelings, for example. Biggest problem I have with counseling people, and I've done quite a lot of it, is not that they are indifferent to their needs, their weaknesses. It is that they are overly consumed with their weaknesses, their failures. The failure syndrome is one of the biggest problems the schools have to deal with. You get young people on a failure syndrome, a failure pattern, and it just plagues them all of their school career. And you get people in the church on a guilt pattern that plagues them all their life. They never feel any good. Christians today rarely feel that they are any good or that God likes them much because they feel like they're always failing, always making some mistake. They don't love Him enough. They don't do enough. They don't give enough. They don't talk to people enough. It's never enough. The image of God that is presented in the church today is that God is never satisfied with us. Because from the pulpit is this constant ravaging of the emotions which tell people that you don't love God enough because you haven't given enough. If you really loved God, you'd give us more money. If you really loved God, you'd get more people into the church. If you really loved God, you'd do this and you'd do that. And nobody thinks they love God at all. So they have a revival meeting, and the pastor is whipping up these emotions. Now, you don't love God enough, let's pray, and let's come forward. And everybody is... It doesn't take a great genius to make a person feel guilty. I'll tell you that. Because we are all too aware of our weaknesses. And all the pastor has to say is, if you only love God enough, you do this and this and this, and you look at yourself and say, yeah, that's right, you see. And you get on a guilt trip. And it just ravages the emotions. It's an unconscionable thing because they're playing with dynamite. If these pastors understood the human mind in the slightest sense, they would understand what damage they're doing. They're putting people on false, illusory, emotional trips to think that they have these feelings about God or they don't have them or whatever. That's why I've been trying to help you understand that the love of God in your spirit is an agape sense of caring that is there the moment the Spirit of Christ comes in and stays there and has nothing to do with all of these surface feelings, good, bad, or indifferent. Some days you're on a downer and some days you're on an upper and some days you feel good, some days you feel bad, some days you like the Lord, some days you don't. But you feel that way about your husband, your wife, your children, yourself, your dog. So I'm trying to help you understand, not that you shouldn't have feelings, but that you should not put any weight on them. You understand? That you shouldn't use them as a whip to beat yourself with. Should you care about how you feel? Yes, intrinsically we do care. The very love of Christ in us is a force that does not permit us not to care. If you're feeling bad about somebody, you don't just say, oh, well, that's the brakes. You care about that. If there's a problem between you and someone else, you care about it. If there's a problem in your family, you care about it. You may not always know just what to do about it. It's the Spirit in us that directs our caring. Now, in the measure that we understand feelings and understand how to handle them, we can live more at peace. It is obviously true that if we have greater understanding of God and His power and so forth, we'll be tend more to peace and more confident in putting our lives in His hands and so forth. That's a subject I will deal with another night. But there are many things to be said about how we handle feelings. We don't actually control feelings. We learn to handle feelings. To control feelings means to restrict them or in some way to falsify them. It isn't the feeling that you're trying to control. It is the actions based upon the feelings you ought to control. If you feel anger, for example, at someone because they've done something to you out of order. Now, it's ridiculous for you to say, I don't feel anger. That's falsification. To try and talk yourself into not feeling angry or to say you shouldn't feel angry. Jesus felt anger. Anger is a rather strong emotion all the way through the scripture. And righteous anger, as we may call it, is not amiss. But you don't have to punch the person in the nose. That's where you control yourself. Nor do you have to get it out. That's a psychological misapplication. The psychologists are great ones for saying, you know, scream and get it all out and tell people what you think of and all that. And there's no proof for that, whatever. As I've often said, the problem with psychology are not the scientific technicalities that have to do with the physiology, with the brain and nervous system and endocrine glands and how they function. The problem with psychology is the therapy notions, how to take care of these illnesses. So more idiotic nonsense that comes out on how to straighten out these emotional problems. But I have no quarrel with psychological knowledge insofar as it has scientific physiological implications. What I have trouble with are the systems of therapy. One man who was at least, if not still there, in your own correctional system, he was a psychologist in one of your facilities, head psychologist, Dr. Glasser, I think the young women's facility there. Anyway, he went through his course in psychiatry at UCLA, went through the doctor's program there and so forth. And when he got through, he said to the heads of the department, he said, "I just want you to understand something. Not anything that I have learned in all the years I've been here at this school has ever helped anyone in any degree that I know of." With that, he walked out on them, and they did not give him a good placement, though. But he was honest about it. He wrote some books called Reality Therapy. He has a lot of good material there. He was the founder of that school called Reality Therapy. But the point I'm making is, in so many cases, it's that therapy system that is the problem and not the basic facts of the brain and the nervous system and so forth. So I use psychology a great deal in terms of the basic scientific knowledge that helps us to understand ourselves. But the leaders need to understand these things so that they can realize what a devastating thing it is to tamper with people's emotions, but the idea that the psychologists have come up with in their therapy notions is that you have to get this thing all out and you've got to say all that you feel and so forth. And that's contrary to the basic essence of the control of our actions and attitudes as adults. There are ways to handle feelings, but you see, we don't control feelings, we handle them by A, recognizing the fickle, flexible, fluctuating nature of them. If you understand that feelings are more products of physiological phenomena than they are of actual understandings, then you would realize how little weight we can put on them. And you know how it is with your human relationships. You've been the best of friends for 10 years, and then something gets said or done and just blows the whole thing. We live in a madcap world. We're all crazy as bedbugs. I'm just really amazed that any of us are able to put things together so well. You know, the more you know about what's going on in this skull, you see, the more amazed you are that we're ever able to put things together enough to get along as well as we do in life. Just like with marriage, I'm more amazed at how few divorces there are than how many. I'm amazed anybody stays together. You know, given all the problems of trying to relate and integrate and organize our lives and give and take, because you spent 20 years of your life living just for yourself and you were the only one you had to please, now you marry somebody, now you've got to integrate with them. But I'm saying to you, I'm right down here in the same milieu with you are, and that God understands this human maze, and He is gracious, flexible, and helps us in it. I see that word comes right out of the scripture. In the first place, David says in Psalm 103, God is aware as a father who pities his children, that is, who feels sympathy with them. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities them that fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we're dust. How often have you heard it said, or you have said, now just remember they're still a child. We may expect too much out of certain levels of development. Now God has to think that with us. Remember, he remembers that we're children. You think you're an adult, you're a child. The older you get, the more you know you're a child. If you think you're not a child, that's when you're more childish than ever. Why? Well, because we're all beset with these human frailties. As we gain understanding about life, as we learn things, as we gain knowledge of God, gain understanding about Him, we're able to level out a lot of these things and live in a steadier way. The older you get, the steadier you should be able to live. Not because you're any smarter, but because you have learned now not to put too much weight on these emotions, you see. And you've learned how easily emotions can be turned upside down. And you learn to watch yourself, you see. You learn to know when your moods come and that you, maybe there are times when you have to kind of hold back a little bit and keep your cool more than at other times. You understand it. Some people are nocturnal types. They like the night, but they don't do so well in the daytime. So they sleep pretty good in the morning, but they toss around in the afternoon a little bit. Now, the nocturnal types may not be too bright in the morning. You know, they get up and they're stumbling around trying to find things. There are some people who pop out of bed at 5 in the morning and they're bright-eyed and they're ready for work. And the other kind of people hate that kind of person. They just hate them. And the little lady comes bleary-eyed into the kitchen to try and make some breakfast, and she's cranky and cross and whatnot, and it's hard to make a lot of sense out of her. Or the man, maybe your husband, he may be saying he's a real bear when he gets out of bed in the morning, and until he gets himself organized about 8 o'clock that evening, he's a bear. Oh, but see, people's feelings fluctuate. I mean, it is so interlocked with the physical phenomena that you're smart just not to pay too much attention to it. One of the problems with depression, for example, is whereas depression is by and large a physiological phenomenon based upon levels of hormones, upon nutrients, upon assimilation of nutrients, upon metabolism, when a depression hits you, what's the first thing you do? You sit down and try to figure out why you're depressed. And it doesn't take much to start a list. Especially if you're thinking about your mates. And, you know, I wouldn't be so, I know what's wrong with me, it's this house. You know. When will he ever get the walls painted? Or when will he ever get the garden fixed up? You know? Or it's the car, I always have to mess with that junk heap out in the driveway there. But your problem is not any of those things. Physiological phenomena. I remember, I'll close with this. Classic example of this, just classic. Woman who came into the office when I was working with a medical doctor, and he did the physiological and I did the psychological. And she came in desperate, an emergency situation on a Saturday. And she was afraid she'd take her life. She was going to commit suicide. The first question I asked her is, do you have a thyroid problem? Yes. How long since you took your thyroxine? Well, about a month ago, because I was getting along so well, I had the doctor give her a booster shot of thyroxine, talked to her for about an hour. She went out of the office feeling great. The physiological problem. She might have committed suicide. Or you could make it a spiritual problem. Get out and pray for her. A lot of things. You just give her a shot and she's all right. Right? Now, that's an excellent illustration of the whole thing. So lots of our mood swings, you see, are physiological factors out of which arise psychological imaginings. And we try to piece together something psychological when it is only physiological. We are only on safe ground as far as this word love is concerned when we are talking about the basic caring consciousness that causes us to be open to God and open to one another. And when we go out beyond that, we're in the fickle valley of human emotions and feelings, and we have to watch our step. There's nothing wrong with feelings. There's nothing wrong with feeling great about God. But you can't depend on these feelings, you see. You can't use them as a gauge of your spirituality. It is absolute, sheer, 100% nonsense to try and gauge your relationship to God in terms of how you feel about God from time to time. It is nonsense. And in many religious communities, church groups, they're playing games with people's emotions on this score, and I think it is unconscionable. And I don't mind speaking out about it. One of the things that would have helped these men a lot is to know the Greek language and what the Bible is written. It would also help them to know the Bible, which many of them don't know. They know their religious textbooks. They got their denominational leaflets. The third thing would help them to know a little bit about the human person, the physiology, the psychology, the processes of the brain and nervous system, not with a one-semester course in seminary on pastoral counseling, but I mean with a thorough knowledge. If you're going to be a guide to people's souls, you better know the wilderness you're guiding them through. It's just one of those sine qua non. Shoddy preparation in the field of faith is just as unconscionable as shoddy preparation in the field of medicine. But people think they're just going to go out and have a prayer and God's going to give them the knowledge and they just preach. Well, I shouldn't get onto that subject. I've got to stop.